Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning and welcome to this third day of our oral argument session. We were supposed to be in Atlanta, of course, but the virus has sort of changed things for us. Our first 2 days of Zoom arguments, I think, have gone pretty well. And we hope that will be the case today, too. So Judge Lagoa, Judge Brasher, and I are very happy to welcome all of you to our session. You have a timer on the screen, which will start green. When that timer goes to yellow, that means that your time is about to finish, so you should begin wrapping up. If we take you beyond your time into the red, then don't worry about it. You're on our time and not yours. And with that, we're ready to begin. Our first case is number 19-11943, Sullivan versus Everett Cash Mutual Insurance Company. Ms. Farrell.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Stacey Farrell. I am counsel for the appellants, Jody and Cindy Sullivan. The Sullivans are Georgia poultry farmers and local property owners, sued the Sullivans and other farmers alleging various liability claims from farming operations. The appellee, Everett Cash Mutual, was the commercial property and liability insurer for the Sullivans. They denied immediately a defense and an indemnity to the Sullivan within days after receiving notice of the first liability suit arising from the farming operations. The Sullivans were forced to decide whether to provide their own defense or to go undefended in the underlying actions. After ECM rejected the Sullivans' bad faith demand, the Sullivans filed suit against ECM. While they were defending themselves in each of the underlying liability actions, due to the ongoing harm of having to defend themselves and continuing to pay for their defense and the uncertainty of having to do that in the future for an unknown amount of time, the Sullivans filed a declaratory judgment action against DCM to address the ongoing uncertainty and the ongoing harm they were experiencing as a result of ECM's breach of contract in bad faith. And then also to address the past harm of the denial, the Sullivan's claims included a breach of contract in bad faith. There are two undisputed facts here that are critical to each of the issues before the court today. The first critical fact is that it is undisputed that the Sullivans had a pending underlying liability suits against them at the time they filed their coverage action against ECM. This is of legal significance because as a result, the Sullivans had an absolute and undisputable right to file a declaratory judgment action against Everett Cash Mutual.
May I ask you a question? It's just a procedural question. The underlying action against the Sullivans was not stayed, correct, in state court?
It was not.
Okay, thank you.
And the Argonaut decision by the Georgia Supreme Court, the 1989 Argonaut decision that's in the briefing, gives the Sullivans this right. Argonaut is squarely on point here. It involved a policyholder who had been denied a defense. They also had a breach of contract action pending against the insurer. And the Argonaut decision stated that the insured had the right to file that declaratory judgment action as a result. And then 2001, Edmund versus Continental Insurance Company recognized Argonaut for that very point and found that a defendant in a pending action, an insured, can maintain a declaratory judgment against its insurer, particularly on the obligation of the insurer's duty to defend, like we have here. Since the beginning of this litigation in 18, ECM has misapplied Georgia law and mischaracterized Georgia law to state that once a denial is issued by the insurer, It's a dead issue. There is no right to file a declaratory judgment action. That's not the case in Georgia. That's not the case in federal law. They rely on Empire State Marine, 1990.
Ms. Farrell, can I stop you for a second?
Yes.
Those declaratory judgment issues are merits issues, and your first argument, I think, is a jurisdictional one, and that is whether or not the district court properly exercised diversity jurisdiction by realigning the parties. Is that right?
It is. I'll move on.
No. You handle the argument as you see fit, but I certainly want you to spend some time discussing the realignment of the parties and the contention or finding that the Greens and Gilberts are nominal parties who can be disregarded.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the reason the declaratory judgment is important, and because of these, and the fact, the undisputed fact of the underlying litigation and the absolute right to file the declaratory judgment, is under Georgia law, as the court is aware, it is required that the third party claimants also be included in the coverage declaratory judgment action.
Are they included as indispensable parties?
Yes, they are. They're included as proper and indispensable parties because Georgia law finds that a declaratory judgment is ripe for dismissal if it does not involve and include as named party all the potentially interested persons in the insurance contract. So here, the Sullivans...
What's the best Georgia case for that proposition?
That is the Johnson case, and in fact... the court's own recent decision, the 2019 decision, if you'll give me just a moment, cited Johnson in a similar case just like this, where the insureds were Georgia citizens and the third claimant parties were as well. And under St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company, the Johnson Supreme Court case of 1960, third party claimants are in underlying suits are required as parties. The Northern District of Georgia 2019 decision and Robinson versus Castile squarely was on this particular issue, where the Northern District of Georgia court said, because of Johnson and relying on Johnson, when you have a proper declaratory judgment action like we had in this case, that the third party claimants are necessary, they're not indispensable, they're not nominal, and they're not fraudulently joined, and removal was not proper because there was no diversity as a result.
That's right. Could you give us the sites, please?
Yes, Robinson versus Castile is 407 F sub 3D 1324, Northern District of Georgia, July 9th, 2019.
Okay. And how about the Johnson case?
That is Georgia Supreme Court case 216 Georgia 437.
What about the realignment of the parties? What do you say about that?
So the lower district court, sua sponte, realigned the parties based on Vescovia Hills, General Fidelity Insurance Company, the 11th Circuit 2012 case. The court realigned the parties stating that because the third party claimants should have been aligned with the policyholders here, the Sullivans, and because of that, there was diversity, all Georgia residents on one side being plaintiffs, and then ECM being the only party positioned as defendants. The reason that was in error was because Vestavia Hills is when you have a judgment already in place, and in fact, in Vestavia Hills, the underlying plaintiff was armed with a final judgment and actually filing suit against both the insurer and the insured. The court realigned the insured with the claimant but the judgment was already in hand. That was not the case here. And in fact, the same lower district court recognized, acknowledged, and applied this particular distinction that the Vestavia Hills is distinguishable and does not apply when there are underlying actions pending against the policyholder at the time of the declaratory judgment.
And is that because if you have an underlying judgment already, then the assumption is that the parties are going to be aligned because the party who the judgment is against obviously would prefer for the insurance company to pay that judgment.
Yes, the parties are aligned in that. And in Sinclair versus Auto Owners Insurance Company is the same district court's decision stating that Vestavia Hills is distinguishable and shouldn't be applied where you have ongoing actions against the defendant, because to align, and it's right on point, to align third-party claimants with policyholders in cases where there are pending underlying claims that remain the same, the property owners here were suing the Sullivans for different tort claims. And Sinclair even says that the interests are not there because third-party claimants would be fine with the policyholders not getting a defense, going into default, and proceeding with litigation with the defaulted policyholder.
Okay, Ms. Farrell, thank you very much. You've saved all of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Ms. Glickoff, I tell me if I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
You are.
Okay. Go right ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Stephanie Glickoff, and I represent the appellee Everett Cash Mutual Insurance Company in this matter. And there are three orders that are at issue in this appeal. There's an order related to the motion to remand. There's the order related to the declaratory judgment dismissal, and the order related to the judgment on the pleadings. I'm going to address.
Can we discuss the remand first, obviously, because if that's incorrect, then we don't have to address the others.
Yes, Your Honor, and that was the order I was going to take on. I was going to address the remand first, and then I was going to skip to the judgment on the pleadings, because I think even if the declaratory judgment action is proper, the judgment on the pleadings would address all those issues. So the remand. The underlying court determined that typically when you have a declaratory judgment action, most times it's filed by an insurance company. They've agreed to defend an underlying, an insured in an underlying liability action. And they file their action, and they will name their insured, and they will name the underlying claimants, because they don't want those claimants to come back afterwards if they win and then say, well, we have a right to this money and under some sort of garnishment which of the policy, which is permitted in Georgia. The district court pointed out in this case that specific idea, that's typically how we see these. The appellant argued that the district court should have applied the Sinclair versus Auto Owners case. And that case was actually decided by the very judge that decided this. So we have no reason to believe that the judge didn't consider that case and decide that it was not applicable. He wrote the opinion.
But isn't the point of realigning the parties is that it's not enough to just to look at the pleading. You have to do a thorough analysis. And can we really say that a thorough analysis was done in this case? I mean, this is a case where you still have pending litigation between the parties. They're clearly adverse still. Just because maybe at some point they may be on the same side against the insurance company doesn't mean at that moment in time they are. Isn't that correct?
They are adverse in the liability action. However, they are not adverse in the coverage action. They have the same goal in the coverage action, which
well, but that's only on the indemnity side, not on the duty to defend side, because the Greens and the Gilberts probably prefer that Everett Cash not provide counsel to the Sullivans. They'd probably rather litigate against pro se parties than have attorneys funded by the insurance company. And so that's why Sinclair and a number of other district court cases from our circuit say that the scenario presented here is different. It's not necessarily the case that everyone is aligned against the insurance company. And the odd thing for me is that, as you mentioned, the same district judge wrote Sinclair, and yet does not even attempt to distinguish Sinclair in the order in this case. And that just seemed very odd to me, because Sinclair seems to be more squarely on point with the facts presented here.
There are two issues that I want to address in response to that. One is the idea that the underlying claimants would not want the Greens or Gilberts to have a defense provided by the insurance company. I believe that the underlying plaintiffs technically do not have an interest whatsoever on the defense of the, a legal interest whatsoever regarding the defense of the underlying defendant of the Sullivan.
But you can't just align a party for one cause of action. I mean, doesn't the alignment have to be for all the causes of action that are raised? I mean, are you making the argument that it's sufficient just to have an alignment on one cause of action?
Not at all. I'm saying they don't have an interest and therefore are a nominal party as to any other cause of action.
Well, how are they not an indispensable party under the rules?
Because they don't, the second prong that I was going to address was the fact that while the underlying case is pending, the issue is not whether the liability case is pending, it's whether the insurance company has drawn the line in the sand, where they've denied coverage or they're agreeing to defend. In the cases where a declaratory judgment has been permitted to go forward, where an underlying case is pending, it is not clear whether the insurance company has given a position regarding the defense. So here, the issue is not whether the liability action is stayed, whether it's reached judgment, whether it's still going on. The issue is whether the insurance company has either agreed to reserve their rights and defend, and it's unclear about whether there'll be ultimately a duty to indemnify, or whether the insurance company has drawn the line in the sand, said, we don't believe there's coverage, we're not going to defend or indemnify. Once that happens, then the insured has the right to file a breach of contract action, because at that point, the insurance company has essentially made their bed, right? So they've either made their bed and they're correct, they've either made their bed and they're wrong and there is coverage, or they've made their bed and they're really wrong, and not only is there's coverage, but they're in bad faith. In this case, Everett Cash decided early on that there's not coverage under their policy for these claims. Therefore, there's no decision to be made. There's no uncertainty. The law in Georgia is very clear with regards to declaratory judgment actions that they're only viable when there is uncertainty, when it's not an advisory opinion. An insurance company, I understand this declaratory judgment action was filed by the insured. However, if Everett Cash, for example, had denied coverage.
Are you suggesting, because I'm just kind of curious, is your suggestion that an insurance company that denies coverage cannot file a DEC action themselves in federal district court after they've denied coverage, saying, we're not sure, we've denied coverage, but we're not sure?
That is accurate under Georgia law and federal law, yes. Because there's no uncertainty. Such would be an advisory opinion. At that point, they've got to sit back and wait and see if they get sued for breach of contract and bad faith. They couldn't turn around.
And what is your best case to answer that proposition?
The cases that stand for that proposition We believe that the Empire Fire and Marine versus Metro Courier Corp. 234 Georgia Appeals 670 is directly on point to this case.
What was it, the site again? I'm sorry.
It's 234 Georgia Appeal 670. It's a 1998 case.
And what federal district, what federal case stands for that proposition as well?
So we don't believe that federal law should apply to the declaratory judgment action. The reason being is that the Federal Declaratory Judgment Act was not raised in the underlying matter and it's not at issue here. The Federal Declaratory Judgment Act in and of itself doesn't confirm jurisdiction under its own language. If it did, we would have just removed on a federal question. Whether a case is determined under federal laws is set by the complaint. Here the complaint references Georgia law. Only jurisdictional questions can be raised for the first time on appeal. That's per the Simononok versus CIT case, 731 F second 743. So that since this was not raised below, it shouldn't be at issue in this court under the federal act. However, in Wright versus Wells Fargo, found at 215 Westlaw 12159206, Northern District of Georgia case, it indicated that a declaratory judgment action was duplicative of a breach of contract action. 11th Circuit case of Tiller versus State Farm found similarly. The only case cited by plaintiffs to refute this is the Lezahava case, which first of all seems to be an outlier among cases, and second of all, it involves an entity's future obligation to pay a mortgage. And in other words, the mortgage company was alleged to have breached this contract, and then the plaintiff wanted to know, well, in light of that, do I have to continue to pay my mortgage payments? Here, there's no question regarding continuation. So not only do we believe that this needs to be determined under Georgia law, which is very clear on this issue, but also that federal law would hold the same. So
could I ask you to turn back to one of the remand issues, please, and address our old decision in Ranger Insurance Company with regards to whether or not the Greens and Gilberts are nominal parties?
Yes, Your Honor. The Ranger case was a case that was filed by an insurer, and it was to determine whether or not a judgment needed to be paid. The Amerisure versus Orange and Blue Construction is 11th Circuit case that is more on point here. And it addresses that the underlying plaintiff's citizenship is not necessary for determining diversity because they're a nominal party. The Sullivans here kind of want it both ways. They want to make an issue of the case being pending when it works for them, and they want to make an issue about the case having a judgment when it works for them also. So they want to ignore the cases that say, well, they have an interest in the judgment when it's beneficial to them. So the Amerisure versus Orange and Blue Construction case is a case that's far more on point than the Ranger case in this, and makes it clear that not only are they nominal, but they should be realigned. And frankly, the only matter the only issue that the Greens and Gilberts are even mentioned in the complaint is that they are said to quote unquote have an interest in the count related to declaratory judgment. And because they don't have an interest, either they have an interest and therefore the declaratory judgment is not proper, or they don't, and it can't be, the plaintiff can't have it both ways. The last issue that I would like to address, because I think that the coverage issues are significant such that the declaratory judgment action would be decided in our favor, assuming that the remand was correctly decided, which we believe it was, then regardless of whether the declaratory judgment action is proper or not, if there's no coverage, we would win on the declaratory judgment count. And thus, for my last minute and a half, I'd like to address the counts of the coverage issues. The main coverage issues here are whether or not there's property damage and whether the pollution exclusion applies. The case law is very clear that those both apply here. The complaints, the nuisance, the trespass, those issues are clearly related to pollutants off this farm as defined by the law and the policy. That's been supported by this court and other federal courts. The property damage is purely economic damage, which has also been deemed by several courts not to be property damage under the policy. Plaintiffs claims that those defenses have been waived. However, it's very clear under the law that you can't waive coverage defenses. These do not relate to policy defenses. These do not relate to cooperation or notice. Therefore, the Hoover case should not be read so broadly as the appellant is attempting to do. These defenses that would otherwise create coverage have not been waived. And therefore, we ask that this court affirm the ruling made by the district court on all three of the relevant orders, find that the case properly belongs in federal court, that the declaratory judgment action is not proper, and that the coverage finds in favor of the insurance company. And thus, even if the declaratory judgment is proper, it should be found in our favor. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Ms. Farrell, you have your remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. To go back to Appellee's point on Empire Fire and Marine, Empire Fire and Marine, the crux of that opinion is that the declaratory judgment was not appropriate because there was an arbitration award already entered. In fact, that decision says that that judgment was a death knell in the right for a declaratory judgment. To suggest anything otherwise is misrepresenting and misinterpreting the case.
Empire in that case conceded that it was the same. What the issues that had been arbitrated were the same, correct?
Yes, and the important, there was no disputing that there was a judgment in the case, and that is the crux of Empire Fire. The Georgia Supreme Court case, Argonaut, is exactly here, where you have
Also, Empire is not a Georgia Supreme Court case. It's an intermediate appellate court in Georgia.
Correct. And there is no Georgia case that I have found or a federal case in this circuit that takes away the insured's right to declaratory judgment action because of a denial. And in fact, the Robinson-Castile case that I gave earlier, the July 9th, 2019 case, is just this. The policyholder filed for a declaratory judgment action. The insurer tried to remove it, claiming these same arguments, fraudulent joinder, nominal parties, dispensable. And the Northern District of Court dismissed all of those and dismissed them almost out of hand and said that because in Georgia law, based on the St. Paul versus Johnson case, defendants, third-party claimants are proper parties. They're not indispensable for diversity purposes. And when they're not diverse from the policyholder, then there is removal is improper, and there's remand. The other thing is that EverCash Mutual, above and beyond their substantive issues and challenges to removal, their notice in and of itself was wholly defective. And that in and of itself, above and beyond this, should have precluded removal and this case have been remanded. Now, Appellee makes an issue out of whether state or federal law applies here. The proper analysis for that is that pre-removal, because this action was filed in Georgia State Court and it was filed under the Georgia Declaratory Judgment Act, the Georgia Declaratory Judgment Act was the operative law. Now, when appellee removed, not the Sullivans, but when ECM removed, because of that, and because the declaratory judgment is procedural, the Evercare case is clear that based on the Erie Doctrine, it automatically converts over to the federal declaratory judgment. But the net effect is nil, because whether under Georgia law or federal law, the Sullivans had an absolute right to declaratory judgment here, where they were fighting and defending themselves at the same time that they were trying to and had the ongoing right and the ongoing damage of providing their own defense because of the breach of contract. That's not an advisory opinion. That is not in any way, shape, or form duplicative recovery. Now, with respect to the motion for remand, Everett Cash knew that they didn't have proper removal. And here's why they knew it, is because instead of just opposing the motion for remand with an opposition brief, they also filed a motion to dismiss the declaratory judgment action before the federal district court, and then requested in their opposition brief to remand, a jurisdictional briefing, that the court first take up the motion for to dismiss the declaratory judgment action, because it was critical and on the overall conclusion to remand. It was absolutely saying the district court had to dismiss the declaratory judgment action first before its remand, before its removal could stand. That is in Everett Cash's own response brief in opposition to remand on page 12. It talks about how they respectfully request the district court to take up the dismissal of the declaratory judgment action because it necessarily is invokes and relates to and the remand decision will be critically impacted by that. So not only is it a blatant concession of the lack of diversity there in and of the pleading itself, and as we all know, that cases can't be removed to federal court that could have never been filed in federal court. This case certainly couldn't have been filed in federal court initially. It took fighting on a declaratory judgment action and removing after they got rid of the declaratory judgment action, and it also flies in the face of the Erie Doctrine.
All right, Ms. Farrell, thank you very much. We appreciate the argument by both of you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you all.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.